The ban is unconstitutional. Iowa Supreme Court says telemedicine abortions in Iowa are here to stay. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. First off this hour, I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden about this morning's ruling on telemedicine abortions. Then, Keisho Scott's thoughts on the Charleston church shooting and the black identity case of Rachel Dolezal. A new study blows away the so-called French fry hypothesis. Iowa kids create hovercrafts in camp. And the College Baseball World Series lights up Omaha. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. First today, a long-awaited decision from the Iowa Supreme Court. It's a decision that is likely to reverberate across the country. It concerns Iowa's first-of-its-kind telemedicine abortion system. This is a system designed to let doctors talk with patients and dispense abortion pills remotely. However, a rule created by the Iowa's Board of Medicine back in August of 2013 effectively banned the system. Now, in a decision issued just this morning, the Iowa Supreme Court has ruled unanimously that the ban is unconstitutional. And this allows Planned Parenthood to continue using the system. Joining us now to explain the ruling and some background, its significance, Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden, who's been following this story. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
First, let's back up and have us understand what exactly this ban was and when and why it was put in place.
Right. So let me start by explaining exactly what a telemed abortion is. So a woman goes into a doctor's office and she's examined by clinic staff, and then she meets with a physician that is either based in Des Moines, Ames, or Iowa City, and the physician confirms that she's pregnant and she's a good candidate for abortion. Then the physician presses a button from the office, and then the drawer opens, and inside the drawer there'll be two medications, mifepristone, also known as RU486, which is a prescription drug that terminates an abortion, and then also misoprostol. The woman takes the mifepristone, the first drug, in front of the doctor with the doctor watching, and then she goes home and takes the second drug at home. So the Iowa Board of Medicine in 2013 ruled that this wasn't a safe way to provide abortion because a doctor wasn't physically present. Also, a woman wasn't doing a follow-up appointment with the patient. So that's how we got to the ban, by when the Iowa Board of Medicine created rules saying that this was that Planned Parenthood had to provide these sorts of this sort of standard of care. Iowa Planned Parenthood, or Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, said that this creates an undue burden and it's not medically necessary to have these sorts of standards of practice. Mm-hmm. And then it ended up at the state Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Also part of the argument, wasn't it here too, that in the meantime, more and more remote medicine is being practiced.
Right, exactly. And in the ruling, Justice Wiggins, who wrote for the majority, said that basically he said that the Iowa Board of Medicine seems more concerned with the way telemed abortion or abortion is provided through telemedicine than other sorts of telemedicine services.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was the court's reasoning, that mm-hmm. why would you leave out this practice when all other medical practices are remotely...
Well, the court's reasoning was more that it was an undue burden.
I see. Okay. So tell us about reaction. I know you've been talking to various parties here, reactions to this ruling this morning.
Right. So I spoke with Iowa Planned Parenthood at a conference call just a little bit ago, and it called it a major victory for the women of Iowa and reproductive rights. Iowa Right to Life, which submitted a petition to the Iowa Board of Medicine back in 2013, saying that this was not a safe way to provide abortion, concerned about the rights, the lives of women. It is an anti-abortion advocacy group in Iowa. They're disappointed, and they plan to continue to fight for the ban or fight against telemed abortion, though they weren't able to go into how or why, partly because it's just so new. And then I also read a press release from the Iowa Board of Medicine. I haven't been able to talk to them in person. And they said that they'll be discussing what this ruling means for telemed abortion and the rules that they established at their July 9-10 meeting. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really say a lot beyond that.
Mm-hmm. So when the Iowa Supreme Court has its say, which it has had in this case, and in a unanimous fashion, does this decision end the legal battle, at least here in Iowa?
Perhaps, probably. So the Iowa Supreme Court gets the final say in the Iowa Constitution, and this decision was based in the Iowa Constitution. However, I'm sure that it's possible that somebody would want to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when it comes to the Supreme Courts and how justices will rule and predicting how justices will vote, it's a very poor idea to make
right.
any sort of prediction. And so I don't think anyone really feels comfortable saying that this is the end of the line. Though, I mean, again, the Iowa Supreme Court gets the final say when it comes to matters of the Iowa Constitution.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about how this is seen across the country, because isn't this telemed abortion system that's remotely counseling
right.
and meeting with women in this case, somewhat unique in the country?
It is. Iowa has the only statewide network of that provides telemed abortion. There is a single clinic in Rochester, Minnesota that provides telemed abortion. Women there meet with doctors based in St. Paul. Beyond that, Iowa is unique, and we've been doing this since 2008. So it is possible that different states might look at Iowa's system and try and establish its own system. I believe that there was a couple clinics in Maryland that for a limited period of time did provide telemed abortions, and they weren't able to continue. So, if you believe that this is a good way to provide abortion, or if you've been looking at this service in your state, you might want to reconsider this service.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio reporter, explaining some of the long-awaited decision from the Iowa Supreme Court. It was handed down today, a decision that says the ban on telemedicine abortion, a system designed to let doctors talk and interact with patients before possibly dispensing abortion pills remotely, that ban is unconstitutional. Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Glad you're along for this Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we heard in our news, the 21-year-old man who was suspected of killing 9 people in one of the South's most storied black churches was charged today with 9 counts of murder and possession of a firearm during the commission of a violent crime. The offenses could lead to the death penalty. Yesterday, before many of the details about the alleged shooter's background and possible motivation were out, I spoke with Keisho Scott of Grinnell College about the church massacre and then about the black identity case of Rachel Dolezal. Keisho Scott is Associate Professor of American Studies and Sociology at Grinnell College. I began by asking her about her initial thoughts on the shooting.
I think my overarching reaction, like most Americans, is why now? And what will be the impact of such an act on the already unfinished agenda around the racial conversations that many people are having about policing, about terrorism, about inequalities in education? And so the biggest part for me is just how this will impact the perceptions that African Americans have and allies have in dealing with the current racial climate in the United States.
Mm-hmm. In looking at the news media coverage of this attack, have you noticed anything there along racial lines?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that stands out for me is that we have different narratives of how things are covered when it's a racial incident or set of conversations. So, for example, we have one news agency, I won't mention a name, who won't even attach the word hate crime in any way. And then we have other news agencies that are free to attach the idea of this being or appearing to be a hate crime. So I think how that's going to play itself out is going to be interesting and impact the conversations that we're going to probably be having in the next couple of days.
Keisho Scott, the second story we wanted to have you address in greater length, Rachel Dolezal. This is the white woman who passed herself off as black. She told the world this week, "I identify as black."
And despite her resignation as president of the NAACP chapter in Spokane, Washington, the uproar over her racial deception has not subsided. What's your reaction?
You know what? First of all, I'm glad that you asked me, and I want people to know that I battled back and forth with the comments that I'm going to make because I did a lot of reading of other people's comments and their reactions. I think the comments fit into three categories. One set of comments are all about how this woman was deceptive and in denial about passing and about misrepresenting African Americans. But another camp, which is very interesting, is people saying things like, look, race is fluid, so what's the big deal? She did good work, she didn't hurt anybody, and, you know, she put her practice to test by being involved in the NAACP, which, by the way, is a multiracial organization. And then there's this other camp, which is really critical of her, because she equates sort of transracial experience with transgender experience. And with the Caitlyn Jenner issue in many of our foreminds, this makes her very controversial. So my reaction is to focus on those camps and their reactions more than to focus on her being evil or bad or doing something, because passing for something has been very much an American experience. That's not a new situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to talk about that a little bit. When we examine her passing herself off as black when she is in fact white, apparently, go into the history. What do we need to understand to grasp what's happening in this conversation about Dolezal?
All right, so that's my second camp where I talk about race is fluid. And one of the things I want to say is that the issue is we know that African Americans and other people of color has passed for white because we have a legal history of a definition of whiteness as having no other kind of blood. We've had the one drop blood rule. So, and we've also had miscegenation laws since, 1924 to 67 when they were legally removed, which, did not allow for racial mixing so that slaves or non-white people could identify as white. So what she, in effect, did is she passed for black, and the real tension is around what she gained by doing that, and that's where there's a split in the community. Did she gain some undue advantage by passing for white, or could she have done the really good work she did with the NAACP and been a white woman and got a great credibility since it was a multiracial organization? So that's kind of the historical way to think about it.
What do you think about her quote, about her saying, I identify as black? Is that possible for a woman with her Caucasian heritage?
Well, you know what? I that's not where I see the wrongness. I don't see the wrongness in that way. I think her stretching herself to be included without being open to the people who she was serving is the problem. But I mean, we have other examples. I mean, Tom Hanks' son is in a rap band, and he has a persona of an African American. He does hip hop music, so there's nothing wrong in imitating aspects of the African American community or any other. And there are countless examples of people that have done that since the 40s and others. But I think the real problem that people have is her identifying with the black experience and saying she's of the black experience because of marriage or parenting children or, going to a historically black school. That's where the tension is for most people. Mm-hmm. And I think that they want to then vilify her for that action. But we have examples of imperfection and people doing good things and also having personal contradictions in many of the American experiences. And mm-hmm. I can name certainly, many of us know those things.
Right. Well, we're talking on a radio network in a state that is overwhelmingly white,
right,
compared to many parts of our country. So as white people, what can we do to be good allies to our African-American neighbors?
Well, you know what? I'm glad you said that, because here are the three things that I think are important. One, let's remember that Rachel Dolezal's experience and the tension and the hotness of her issue right now, she's also should be seen in the context of American racial history, not just the African American experience. So her negotiating this is not in a vacuum. Even white people passing for something is in the context of American history. The second thing I think is important is that why wouldn't it be okay to identify with something that challenges inequality? We have many people that did that, you know, historically and otherwise, and continue. Many young people identify with oppressed groups of various kinds. So I don't think that's really the issue. The issue is the honesty around it. And so the teaching moment for me is about lying about her identity. I think it was a mistake in judgment, but I think her work can stand alone. I mean, you know, I go back to the founding fathers of the country. Thomas Jefferson, you know, I mean, come on now. Thomas Jefferson had slaves. Thomas Jefferson had a mistress. Thomas Jefferson had a wife. Thomas Jefferson, had a number of contradictions, but who is ever going to want to negate, you know, this 37-year-old man writing the Declaration of Independence? So we have countless examples of contradictions. I think she made a poor judgment. By the way, I told my daughter last night, you know what, I think I'll pass for white. And we know, for an example, through the Genetic Project, that one-fourth of African Americans are probably, no, the majority of African Americans are one-fourth probably some European descent, but they don't go around talking about being white. But if I wanted to say that, the general perception would impact it. So part of this is a perception of this politics of passing. So I don't want her to be only beat up for doing that, because this is negotiated on a larger agenda of race politics. And it's hot now because, you know, the whole country is looking at, you know, the polarization of who protects racial identities right now. So mm-hmm. I think I'm going to leave it at that.
This case, a conversation, mm-hmm. no doubt, that you'll talk about in many classrooms situations in Grinnell College as a professor of American Studies.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what does it mean to be an American is an unfinished question. It is an ongoing question, and it is totally negotiated. And there are ways that we do it right, and there are ways we do it wrong. And the implication for allyship is on how we answer those questions. So I read about 902 reactions to Rachel's choice, and they were attacking her personally. I think I want to focus on what the principal issue here was, and that is the kind of wrongness in not being open and honest. The people that were involved in the civil rights movement who left their Ivy League colleges and Grinnell College and joined the civil rights movement were open about their agenda, and that's pretty much what a lot of the rub is about. Why she just wasn't open about what she was doing to the people that she wanted to be part of.
Keisho Scott, Associate Professor of American Studies and Sociology at Grinnell College. Always wonderful to talk with you, Keisho.
Thank you so much. And we'll all keep our heart open to this tragedy that has happened in South Carolina. Thank you for calling me.
Okay. Thank you, Keisho.
You bet.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's known as the French fry hypothesis, and it's been busted. University of Iowa scientists have found that adding high salt to a high fat diet actually prevents weight gain in mice. That was this test. Joining me now to discuss it, Justin Groby, assistant professor of pharmacology at the University of Iowa, co-senior author of this new study, which was published in the journal Scientific Reports on June 11th. Justin Groby, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for having me.
So, fast food lovers rejoice or not?
Well, that's a good question. It is lunchtime, so it's appropriate that we talk about this, right?
Yep.
Really, our study, we're approaching what we call the French fry hypothesis. And really, the question was, we know that salt tastes good. We know that fat tastes good. And we know that foods that have a lot of both, such as French fries or potato chips or whatever, you know, tasty food you want to pick on, has a lot of both. And there's been this idea in the scientific realm for a while that when you have lots of high salt and lots of fat in a food, that it gets tasty, and maybe we eat too much of that food, and maybe that's why we're getting obese. So really, our study was asking the question, in the context of a high-fat diet, what does salt really do to your body? And, you know, does that actually contribute to the weight gain?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here I, for this purpose, Justin, I pulled out a chip from my desk. Actually, I didn't have any salty potato chips. This is a low-salt pita chip. Just took a bite of it. Are you saying that it would have been better if I would have had a real salty potato chip?
Let's be very clear about what we mean by better. If it were, you know, salt covered or, you know, regular salt potato chips, most people prefer that over the low salt version, just based on their taste and their ingrained preferences. And so that was the question, you know, is this actually leading to our obesity epidemic?
Mm-hmm.
And so as a card-carrying member of the American Heart Association, it's my job to dutifully clearly state more salt is not good for you. More
okay.
salt is definitely bad for you.
Okay, up with my pita chips. Good.
Yes, keep up the low salt pita chips. That's a very good choice. But really, you know, how low should we go is kind of a ongoing public policy question. And just to be clear, we did this study in mice. And we were studying their metabolic physiology. And so this is not going to dictate any public policy. I'm not going to commit to a specific number on how much sodium that people should be eating. But we really were interested in studying what does the salt content do to your metabolism in your body, or the mouse's body in this case, in the context of a high-fat diet.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds also like what you're saying is that not all calories are created equal.
That is exactly right. And that's a phrase that my collaborator, Mike Luter, psychiatrist here at the University of Iowa, really likes to use when we're talking about this. Really, the major take-home point of our study is that we found that these non-caloric nutrients, for example, sodium, really play a major role in regulating how our body handles caloric nutrients like fats and carbohydrates and proteins.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really really unappreciated, I think, up until this point. And this finding that more salt in the context of a high-fat diet will reduce digestive efficiency and therefore reduce the weight gain, at least of mice fed this diet, is really pretty exciting to our field.
Okay, so what needs to happen? We've got a minute or so left here. What needs to happen now? What questions has this raised that perhaps we'll be in follow-up studies?
You know, there's a lot of exciting data that's been published over the years about how does salt or how do fats individually, when we modulate them in isolation, how do they affect our physiology? There's a lot of literature on that, but this really highlights the need for a lot more work into what is the synergy between these nutrients. When you're talking about a high-fat diet, does sodium affect us differently than if you're on a low-fat diet?
Okay, so you going to go open a bag of potato chips or get some fries for lunch after this interview?
Yes, enjoy.
Okay, thank you very much
for
sharing with us. Justin Groby, assistant professor of pharmacology at the University of Iowa, co-senior author of the new study, which is published in the journal Scientific Reports, which seems to bust the French fry hypothesis. He and his colleagues have found that adding high salt to high fat diets actually prevent weight gain in mice, as he clearly pointed out. So, fast food lovers over the noon hour, I guess you can kind of rejoice. The jury's still out on that one. Coming up in just a moment, this is fun. I got to go outside the studio. Hope you'll come along after the break. I'll go to a camp. It's not the one with kayaking or fishing or hiking. These kids are creating hovercrafts in a camp here in Iowa. We'll talk with them and get the ideas behind this camp as well. Also, the College Baseball World Series is lighting up Omaha. We'll find out about that when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a NewsBuzz edition. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, outside the studio for this segment of our News Buzz on Friday. I find myself with Mark Ginsburg in his business in Iowa City. He's owner of MC Ginsburg Objects of Art in downtown Iowa City. And I've come here to learn about a very interesting, well, summer camp of sorts. Mark's store not only sells jewelry, but
He works as an artist incubator. It's also a research facility for a wide cross-section of disciplines, from, say, mini furniture for hobbyists to practice models of the human body for surgeons. And this week, he's working with students from the University of Iowa's Bell and Blank Center with 3D printers and computer-aided design. They're attempting to make, wait for it, hovercrafts. Mark Ginsberg, welcome back to our program.
It's a pleasure to be back, and thanks for having me, Ben.
So, well, next door to us right now, we have, looks to be a dozen or so more talented students who've been working here all week. What's the idea they're pursuing here?
This is an interesting split from what the university typically does. Usually the campuses are, or the classrooms are on campus. They're not housed in any private environments. We have 18, 12 to 14-year-olds here from around the country, mostly Iowa, but they're coming from as far away as California and New York City and places in between. We are trying to educate them on the science, the technology, the engineering, and we're adding art to this and math. So instead of just a STEM-type approach to the classroom, it's a STEAM approach. We feel that the art is part of the solution. So today, or this week, they are working on building their own miniature hovercrafts. We are actually scanning each one of these students' faces, so their avatar will be themselves inside of the hovercraft. Mm-hmm. So we'll have a completely three-dimensional model of each one of the students' faces. The scanner that we have is a standalone scanner that the kids are going to be able to operate, and it will go right to a stereolithography file that will be printed and then put inside the hovercraft. But the idea is to give them a hands-on, more intensive approach to science and to art and to engineering and to math, and be able to cross over disciplines. The unusual part about this is that it's held in what's 600 square feet of jewelry store on the first floor, and then about 1,000 square feet of advanced design and manufacturing on the second floor. But this is a pilot project for the Bell and Blank program, and I'm very flattered and happy that they've seen to Lori Eirig and Nicholas Colangelo, Susan Asseline, and those that are related to these programs have the foresight to allow this kind of interaction.
Okay, yeah, we are, to describe the area, I mean, describe the place we find ourselves. This is a shop, a place where manufacturing done. Describe some of the things we're seeing right around us.
Yeah, we're basically a miniature version of a General Motors. We have laser welding, we have vacuum casting, induction thermal casting for more finicky metals like stainless steels and platinums. We have two 3D printers, we have CNC mills that will actually cut away an object. So the difference between 3D printing or 3D manufacturing, additive manufacturing, and subtractive, as in a mill, is that with additive manufacturing, as in a 3D printer, you start with zero and you end up at 100%. And with subtractive, you start with a solid block of, let's say, wood, and you cut it down to the model you're trying to make. So it starts at 100% and goes to 30 or 50. Mm-hmm. So we have those machines as well. We have 18 different computers in here that are tied into computer-aided design programs. I have two of my employees that are acting as teachers here. One is a mechanical engineer, graduate of the University of Iowa. The other is an MFA in sculpting. That came out of UNI and also did some of his undergrad work at Iowa. And then Kevin Wilkerson, who is a high school teacher, industrial arts in Williamsburg. And the other two were Ji Yoon and Banak Tamavong.
Okay. Mark, we want to step next door in a minute and talk to at least a couple of the students here about what they're doing.
So let me introduce you to Banak Tamavong, one of the instructors for the program this week. And Banak's background, as I said earlier, is MFA in sculpting. He's a manufacturing engineer as well and extremely versatile in the platforms of computer-aided design. So Banak, let me introduce you to Ben.
Banak, welcome to the program. Tell us about your role in what you're having the students do here.
Well, my role is more of the creative side of things, whereas Kevin was having them do kind of the mechanical stuff with the cars and the designing and the engineering software. I'm having them more on the creative software, where we're working character design, basically, so designs that could be used for animation or game design.
Mm-hmm. Mark was saying earlier that the avatars will be in these hovercraft, so that part of it is something that you deal with?
That's right, that's right. So they initially designed little hover cars first, and based off of their personalities, what I wanted them to create was either their nemesis or their hero that would be driving that car for them. And right now we're kind of in the process of brainstorming what their nemesis or heroes would look like from their perspective, and figuring out how we kind of CAD model those things out to give them the characteristics that they wanted. So they're learning how to make things look really, really dark and doomy, gloomy kind of stuff, or really happy, bunny, fluffy kind of stuff.
This sounds so amazing for an experience for kids in their teens. Tell me why you feel it's important, and Mark obviously feels it's important, to marry the art with the technical side of it, so that it's not just one or the other.
Well, coming from a guy who came from the art world into the engineering world, I find that art kind of informs the way that you go about doing things and the inspiration that you get for doing things, whereas the engineering stuff are the method and processes for doing that stuff. And when you combine the two together, it makes the object have a life of its own and breathe a little bit better versus being stuck in kind of this box and categories and all that kind of stuff. So for me, it's not only an outlet, but it's also an inspiration for a project.
Mm-hmm. And I bet it creates a lot of excitement with the kids, more than just a purely technical excitement.
Oh yeah, I mean they love the engineering side, they love mechanical things, and they love learning the technical stuff, but you can really see their eyes kind of light up when they get to design their own character or scan their faces and make part of their faces as part of the project as well. So I find that it brings life to the project for them as well.
Banach, thanks for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
So Mark, now you brought us into a room, the adjoining room here, where these students, these teenagers, all have laptops and a variety of figures on them. These are their avatars, and what's going on?
Yeah, well, I think right now what they're doing is they're animating their faces so that it goes into the hovercraft as their avatar. But what you're looking at here is the next generation of what I think are going to be the thinkers and the doers of our world. So you can see it's multicultural and multiple sexes and ages between 12 and 14. It's exciting to see this kind of intersection of campus.
Okay, I see one, a couple kids with dots all over their faces.
Those are ceramic dots that actually define where the laser is in space on X, Y, and Z. So it's basically a GPS coordinate. And once it has that locked in, you can walk around the room and come back to the laser and it knows who you are and where you've been. So it will keep track of you, and this is a handheld laser.
And keep track of your facial expressions?
It'll keep track of everything, and it'll be able to tell where you are in space just from the ceramic dots that are on you.
Wow.
I mean, the trade-off is you have a bunch of ceramic dots, so it looks like you have the black and white measles. But in any case.
I'm sure they don't mind that. Let's go talk with a few. You're sitting here at a computer, and you've got a young man here with some of these ceramic dots all over your face. Hi, what's your name?
Andrew.
Andrew, you don't have a disease. Thank goodness you don't. So you're having an avatar made of your face. This is really cool technology, isn't it?
Yeah.
And here to instruct you is G. So what's happening here right now? You're scanning him?
Yeah, I'm scanning him, and in early morning he learned how to use Mesh Mixer, which is really good program that, you know, for animation. You know, he can make a sculptural object, and he can basically, what we are going to do now is scan his face and then put his scanned face file into Mesh Mixer, and he's gonna go have fun, change his face, or change his face or sculpt it or do whatever he wants. Actually, there's no rule here. This is about the creativity, so he can just have fun. It's all about having fun. So.
Okay, so Andrew, you're making an avatar. You're supposed to make either, what, a hero or a nemesis? Whoops, one of your ceramic dots fell off. There you go. Is your guy an evil person or a good doer?
An evil person.
Oh, no. Why did you pick that?
It's fun.
It is. Okay, we'll let you get done with your scanning. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. My name is Ben from Iowa Public Radio. What's your name?
Ananya.
Ananya. The hover cars are designed, and they're actually going to be made here?
Yep.
Are you happy with the way you're turned out?
Kind of. I couldn't get the wiring right.
The wiring?
Yeah, because we're using motors, and then the track is on, like, is connected to, like, a generator. So the wires connect to the generator, and then it makes the car move. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it will really work?
Yeah. It worked for a bit, but then I kind of messed with it.
Uh-huh.
Describe what your hover car looks like.
It's an old model Ford, like on a board.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Mark, this is fascinating to compare what we had as kids to do during the summer with this. It blows your mind, doesn't it?
It's a new world, Ben. You know, imagine these people will be designing homes if they become architects that are smart enough to know when the dishwasher breaks in the garage, it'll be printing a new part for the dishwasher and instruct you how to replace it, or the refrigerator, or a curtain rod, or, you know, everything will be fixable at the time that it breaks inside of a home. And eventually, everything will be fixable that breaks inside of a body. So, I mean, this is the future. We're building, even on this campus here at Engineering Research, we're building the first versions of blood vessels that will recreate pancreas. And once we get to that point, which is maybe 7 or 10 years down the road, we've eliminated diabetes. We'll have organs like hearts and livers and lungs and kidneys that will be replaceable from the epidural in your lower spine. So it's amazing to think in the next 15 or 20 years that we'll be around, hopefully, to see this kind of evolution.
Okay, and we'll be depending on kids like these to push us on into new frontiers. And thanks for pointing that out to us. Mark Ginsburg of MC Ginsburg Objects of Art in downtown Iowa City. Mark and his colleagues are working with students from the University of Iowa's Bell and Blank Center using all kinds of fascinating things, CAD, computer-aided design, and 3D printers. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The annual College World Series is going on now in Omaha, Nebraska. It's the culmination of the NCAA Division I Baseball Championship, which determines the NCAA Division I College Baseball Champion. Steve Pivovar is with us, reporter for the Omaha World Herald. He has covered the College World Series for the World Herald since way back in 1982. Hi, Steve.
How are you, Ben?
I'm doing fine. So what's happening this year? Catch us up on the tournament.
Well, we're heading into the home stretch. There's four teams left. Texas Christian, Vanderbilt, the defending national champion, Virginia and Florida. And by the weekend, we'll know the two participants in what will be a best of three championship series. And sometime early next week, we'll have either a new national champion or Vanderbilt will be the repeat national champion.
Is, in your eyes, or from what you're hearing, is Vanderbilt favored again this year?
Well, they're playing well at this point, but they still have at least one game to win that would put them into that championship series, and they're playing a very feisty Texas Christian team, so there's no assurance that they'll be able to make it. That's kind of what makes the series fun.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any big upsets so far this year?
Well, not really. Most of the teams that made it to Omaha are what you would consider name brands in college baseball. You know, mm-hmm. Iowa was a tournament participant this year. They had a chance to try to advance to Omaha. They came up a little bit short, but you know, every college baseball team wants to get to the tournament and wants to try to get to Omaha. Omaha has become kind of college baseball's brand name as far as the national championship's concerned. Teams don't talk about going to the championship, so to speak. They talk about going to Omaha, and that's because of Omaha's long involvement with the NCAA.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the big names that you're seeing in this year's tournament, pitchers, batters that people are taking note of.
Well, you know, part of the magic of this thing is that you get to see guys before they, you know, maybe head on to that next stage and become bona fide major league stars. I mean, over the course of the years, Barry Bonds has played here, Paul Molitor has played here, Dave Winfield has played here, guys that you know, are either Hall of Famers or have gone on or could become Hall of Famers someday. This year, kind of the story of the tournament is the quality shortstops are here. Vanderbilt has a young man by the name of Dansby Swanson. He was the first player picked in the Major League draft that was held about a week ago. If I see him play in Omaha, there's probably a good chance I'll see him play in the Major League someday.
Okay, Steve Pivovar, a reporter for the Omaha World Herald, has been covering this College World Series for the World Herald since 1982, and I understand you almost go back to the beginning of it. You attended your first one when you were 7 or 8 years old in 1959?
Yeah, my dad, the first ball game my dad took me to was a College World Series game, and I don't have exact memories of what game that was and exactly what year it was. But again, it was probably when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I was born in 52. The series, again, came to Omaha in 1950. And at those, you know, for about the first 20 to 30 years, it was a nice little baseball tournament that Omaha had each year. The advent of it becoming a fixture on national television has caused the event to, just really explode and blossom over probably the last 30 years or so. And, it's one of those things where there's a lot to do outside the stadium. There's what they call the baseball village where you can get anything you want to eat and most likely to drink. There's venues for bands. There's a fan fest outside the stadium. So it's really more than just a baseball tournament these days.
Okay, Steve Pivovar, thanks for all the information. Reporter for the Omaha World Herald, thanks, and I wish you a good weekend of baseball.
No problem. I appreciate being on the show.
And before we say goodbye on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News and launch into our weekend, I want to talk with Charity Nebbe, host of Talk of Iowa, because coming up in July, Mondays on July, we're going to be doing our summer series again. This year, we're focusing on jobs. Hi, Charity.
Hello, Ben. And it is going to be really fascinating, I think, when we sat down and started talking about what different areas of jobs in Iowa we'd like to explore. We came up with a list that was twice as long as it needed to be.
Right. We just bubbled with all these things. And the exciting thing about this series is that it involves almost everyone in our audience. We really are going to depend on you, our listeners, to get back to us and make this conversation about different facets of jobs really bubble with
Absolutely.
Ideas and experiences that you've had.
Right. And, you know, we've already picked the general topics for the shows that we're going to do. Like, we're going to focus on the service sector on one of the first shows. We're going to talk about minimum wage jobs. We're going to talk about the wage gap and a lot of really important issues. But we've also put together a survey on the Public Insight Network. And you can share your experiences with us. And we hope that you will, because I know that so many people have fascinating stories and life experiences that have to do with their work that they can share with us. So this is really your opportunity to shape the shows that we're going to be doing in July.
Right. And in case you're saying Public Insight Network, what's that? Well, you go to our website, right? And there's a big dial or big red button. It says PIN, Public Insight Network. Go there. And,
right.
And then what happens?
Well, you just click on the survey that we've put together. You have to put in a little bit of information about yourself, and then you can go through the survey and you can share your experiences. You don't have to fill everything out, but if there's something that really applies to you, we'd love to hear your story. And this is a network that hopefully will connect us to people with really unusual personal stories around the state of Iowa.
Here's an unusual story that one of them, you mentioned the service sector that we'll be featuring in this series. A server from Des Moines once got a $500 tip.
Yes.
Now, I hear that on radio. I remember that. Right? And, you know, really, great radio and what we're doing here and the type of journalism that we're doing at Charity is built on the narratives of Iowans. Stories good and bad, perhaps. We're
right.
going to be also looking
we
at...
We all have stories about our jobs, don't we?
Yes, we do. We're going to be looking at dangerous occupations as well. Working in agriculture has long been seen as one of the most dangerous occupations.
going to look, probe that side of working too. What else have we got going here, Jeremy?
Well, I mentioned the service sector, and I'm really excited about that because people have such great stories about working in the service sector, and there is the, you know, the push and pull between the people who are hired to serve people and how people who are being served treat those people. That there are a lot of tension there.
As a former busboy, I can only say yes. Exciting.
We're also going to talk about delaying retirement, which is a growing trend in Iowa and around the rest of the country, and in that, we'll also get into kind of second careers as well. We will talk about job burnout, which a lot of people know far too much about.
Charity will also be talking about preparing students for jobs.
Right. I mean, that's something that comes up in the news all the time. Of course, the universities focus their programs to prepare students to go out into the real world. How is it working? Are we connecting with reality? Are our students getting jobs and having fulfilling careers in the areas that they study? I think there are a lot of very interesting questions to explore along those lines.
Okay, so hopefully we piqued your interest and you will join in the conversation and be part of this summer series with your job story. And the way you do that is to go to iowapublicradio.org and find that big red button, PIN, the Public Insight Network, and fill out that survey. We hope we hear from you. And Charity, we've got the engines revved up.
That's right. We'll start on July 6th.
We'll start on July 6th. Thanks for coming in, Charity.
Thank you, Ben.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.